Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching. I'm Vanity Fair Chief Critic Richard Lawson.
And I'm Vanity Fair's TV critic, Sonia Soraya.
So for those of you just joining Still Watching somehow in episode 2 of Succession, what we do on this podcast is we pick a show and we follow it through the season, episode by episode. We break down what happened, theories. We respond to listener emails, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. And on occasion, like today, we have interviews with people who worked on the show. So we are in episode 2 of Succession. We really are in, getting into the meat of this season, it feels like. In a very exciting episode that I feel like, would you classify this as a bottle episode, Sonia? It's not quite, but it's all one location for at least a lot of the characters.
Yeah, I guess it's not technically a bottle up because people do leave, like, the set, but it does have that quality of, like, everyone is just, like, the siblings are all in the apartment. And they're, like, kind of forced to all deal with each other. And that I really liked that quality, too.
Yeah, because I was thinking about it. It's not that often that we see the four children alone mm-hmm. together talking mm-hmm. about whatever. You know, because it's usually, like someone else is there that they're kind of bouncing off of. But this is just the four of them together, which felt kind of rare.
Yeah, I was actually impressed that Connor was invited. I was not expecting it, but yeah. So at the very end of the last episode, we see Shiv in the car. It definitely looks like she's sending her car to Kendall's apartment, and then it turns out in this episode that Kendall has kind of called all four of them, or sort of summoned them with his personal magnetism. And then the other thing that's interesting about this episode, which I think adds to that sort of sense of like heightened tension, is that we're still kind of in the same day. It's all the same night. So the first episode was like during that day, and then they land in New York. Greg and Kendall are in that car while Logan and everyone else are flying around. And then this is like the night that everyone makes it to New York, and Jerry's in the office, like in the Waystar Royco office, like settling into her new digs, and everyone sort of converged on Kendall's apartment. So I really liked that sense of immediacy.
Yeah, I'm curious how long they can sustain that sort of, not real time exactly, but you know, like how much of this, like, are we going to have any sort of time jumps coming up, like a week from now or whatever? I mean, I assume we'll have to, but I think that, like, to reintroduce us to the new season, especially when it's been so long since we had the last one, it feels good to just kind of roll into it at such a sort of unbroken pace. We're going to go character by character. I think that we've decided that's the best way to kind of cover this sprawling, opera of stories. We are also going to hear, Sonia, you have a conversation with Alan Ruck, who plays Connor, and I think he's not a huge part of this episode, but I think he serves a really kind of vital purpose in it. So I'll be curious to hear that conversation. Where do you want to start? I think Kendall's probably a good place to start, right?
Yeah, I think Kendall's where we should start, because I think one of the things that was fun about this episode is that, last week, it was Logan that sort of was like at the center of all of this drama. And this week it's Kendall who sort of pulled everyone into his, into his orbit. He's definitely still feels a little unhinged to me, but I think something that I really enjoyed was that by the time that he got the siblings together, he's kind of making this interesting case for, like, I mean, it's sort of like he's making a case for, like, a moral philosophy of the universe that's, like, different from what his father's presented them. And the ways that they all respond, which is, like, so skeptical and hostile even, I think was, like, so indicative of how deeply rooted whatever Logan's values are in all of them, even though they're also damaged. It was such an interesting moment. And then, of course, Kendall also does it poorly. Like, he, you know, I think that he's in the right. Like, he's right about this cruise ship crisis. Like, he's right that that was the wrong, you know, that was, like, a bad thing that happened. But he's also, like, you know, like someone who literally killed someone in the first season, and he's out here sort of advocating for, like, everyone else needs to do the right thing. I thought it was interesting also that as the siblings, his siblings kind of turn him down, he goes completely, like, just starts saying things that are, like, so inappropriate, so toxic. I think that was, like, to me, all very indicative of, like, it doesn't matter. Like, Kendall still has so much he needs to, like, figure out for himself. He even makes this joke about how he has, like, he doesn't know how he feels about his dad, but he's going to outsource it to his therapist. I also don't think Kendall is actually in therapy, but I was just, like, very interested in him sort of, like, backgrounding or kind of, like, distancing himself from, like, clearly the really big issues that are going on, like, psychologically, to sort of make it about this sort of moral philosophy that he doesn't have a great handle on. And then eventually, you know, this whole thing doesn't work.
Yeah. The portrait of him so far this season is so interesting because it courts sympathy or empathy or something, mm-hmm. Because he's saying some things that, like, sound decent. The problem is you kind of have to, like, audit where they're coming from and how sincere they are. You know, on the one hand, there's that sort of, I don't know why I found this kind of heartbreaking, but I forget who's coming into the apartment, but he's like, oh, so-and-so in the house, like this kind of, you know, kind of slightly antiquated, cool guy turn of phrase. That, like, made me think about, like, what Kendall was like in college. And I bet he kind of tried to be, like, one of the guys, you know, like, clearly swaggering with the massive sense of entitlement and also plans to, you know, take over his father's empire. But, like, I think there is an aspect of Kendall that's just trying to be, like, your run-of-the-mill, like, cool, decent guy, but he has no idea how to do it, you know? And so here we have, later, when he's kind of making his pitch to his siblings, this thing that sounds better, certainly, you know, a more responsible, more contemporary company with you know, sort of adapting to the mores of the day way more than certainly Logan has. But he also talks about having a global media empire where they are the, you know, the chief source of information around the world, which is, like, mm-hmm. super villain evil.
right. He's definitely, like, he's drawn to that sort of self-aggrandizing grandeur, even as he's sort of trying to argue, like, and I think the siblings really are really skeptical of him kind of for that reason. You know, I think that I sort of sympathize with Kendall's perspective because I feel like I appreciate how much he's sort of trying, but I totally hear you. He has this sort of, like, you know, the way it makes me think is like a desperate bar mitzvah guy, like the sort of, like, I'm really going to make this party the coolest, like, 13-year-old yeah. party ever. Like, he has this sort of weirdly needy energy. And, you know, the thing that kind of breaks them apart ultimately is, you know, Shiv and Roman in particular are being like, well, does that mean that you are going to be in charge? Like, so you're saying that dad's not going to be in charge, but are you putting yourself in that position? And he's like, oh, like, yeah, like, I think, like, I could, like, take on that role for a little while. Like, he sort of makes it sound like he's doing them a favor. And I think, like, I think it's sort of frustrating how much everything becomes about personal power in this family. But I think also rightly, they're like, we don't really see how that makes our lives different. Like, you're going to have to prove that you're actually, like, a more stable and more put together person than our dad right now, in order to, like, become our boss for, like, perpetuity.
Yeah, and I think a funny thing about Kendall that's been true of since season one is that when it comes to his siblings, he seems constantly baffled that they don't see him as the heir apparent. Like, that, you know, he's like, but this is the narrative. And they just refuse to accept that. And it just seems to, like, consternate him all the time. And he got so whipped up in this, like, you know, this big public press conference. He's, you know, flipped the dinner table over and he's ready to, like, you know, regime change, all that. And he just assumes that that means that Shiv and Connor and Roman will just fall in line behind him. And then they're like, nope, like, we still don't want that, you know. And he's just like, so I don't know. I think that maybe is part of where the empathy comes in, because, like, you just see this guy, like, knocking on the same door over and over and over again now for three, you know, well, two seasons and a couple episodes, and it's just refusing to open. And you're just like, Kendall, maybe try a different door. But he doesn't, you know.
No,
that way, I guess.
He needs this so bad. And that's, and I think, honestly, like, if I were one of his siblings, I think even the fact that he needed it so much would be kind of a red flag. Like, you know. Well. Anyway, my sort of campaign for all of the Succession kids to go to therapy is, like, a separate issue. But I think there were so many really interesting tonal shifts throughout this whole conversation. Like, for example, something that interested me was that, you know, Shiv makes a joke about Roman. Says that it makes a joke that refers to Jerry as Roman's mom, and he gets so upset that he has to, like, leave the room, and then Connor has to go get him. And I loved that, because it's, like, actually a classic sort of family fight thing that, like, someone gets overwhelmed and someone has to go kind of retrieve them. Again, sort of has this, like, you know, like, middle school or high school energy to it too. But then I also just appreciated that everyone's like most intimate issues are really being triggered by this power struggle.
Yeah, and she says something also about his, like, sexual performance issues, right?
Right, yeah.
And, like, that's obviously a sore spot for him. But then when he comes back, we're getting ahead of ourselves, but that's okay. But yeah. Shiv says, like, sorry, you know, in this kind of little voice that clearly is maybe a voice that this family does, like, all families have those kind of tics or whatever. And embedded in that, you're like, okay, is Shiv being a sociopath here? Is there, but I think there is a glimmer of these kids, I'm even Connor, yeah, like, do see moments where, like, right and wrong are distinguished, and they kind of know, maybe from schooling, if not their father, or like something, some portion of their lives in the world, like, have taught them, like, that is the right thing, and it is good to apologize, but, like, it's always masked under this other thing, this irony or this, you know, belligerence, whatever it is. And I think, you know, you see that with Kendall, where he's, like, talking about the cruise ship scandals, and he's like, we all knew, you mm-hmm. know, and he's inviting this moment of atonement in a sense, but, and Connor kind of goes along with it, but the other two are just sort of like, oh, I mean, I had a hunch. I don't know, you know? Mm-hmm. And so we've gotten to a moral point on the show where, like, the good thing to do is to admit your complicity in a massive system of, you know, sexual harassment and worse. And they can't even do that.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, let's talk about Connor. Let's go through the siblings. Let's talk about Connor first, though, because I totally think you're right. Like, there's this even the language that the childish syllables of Sawi that Shiv uses. They're in this very childish mode, but Connor is not. Connor is older. Connor has more, he's been doing this, whatever this is, being Logan Roy's kid for longer. And so when we first see him in the episode, it's when he's back from his from the Balkans, and it was so funny because we had talked about his holding down the fort thing so much, and he was self aware about that, you know. Yeah. And he says to on the phone, he says, "Oh, you mean Operation Thumb Twiddle," and then makes a really funny joke. To me, very funny. He seemed more anguished about how he had to fly on a commercial plane with refrigerated cheese.
He says scheduled.
I
had to fly scheduled, right? Like, meaning, right. Like, you know, the masses that were that you can't tell them what time to take off. And he genuinely seems to be like, it was miserable.
No, he seems really upset. Yeah. So you kind of start there with him, which is kind of this sort of like, I don't know, perhaps wounded pride, maybe. And then he shows up at Kendall's apartment and plays this sort of older brother role throughout this conversation. He, you know, he says, "We all knew," and he's trying to point out to Roman and to Shiv, who are both like very like, "We didn't know. What did we know? What did we really know?" And he's trying to push a little bit more like, "I think you guys were more aware of the problems in this company than you realized." And then is in the room when, I guess, is the person who receives the donuts that are sent from Logan. I really thought it was so funny how they were all so unraveled by the donuts, which he deems to be probably safe to eat. But it's funny because I think the donuts actually do end up influencing what happens right after that, because right after the donuts arrive, they're all back in the main room, and Connor says to Kendall, like, I can't do this with you. And Kendall's like super, super mean about it. He gets super mean about everyone turning him down. But what Connor says ultimately is like this kind of antiquated idea that it's not, it's definitely not right to kill your father, but he's sort of talking metaphorically, and he's like, it's not right for me to go against my dad. And that's the last we see of him in that episode.
Yeah. I think there's a line where he says, about the poison donuts, where he's like, you think he's going to send poison donuts to where his granddaughters live or something. Mm-hmm. And it's a nice idea that Logan would even think that far, but like, Kendall doesn't care about his kids. Like, I don't think Logan cares about those kids, you know? Speaking of the kids, I thought it was a funny detail when they're in Sophie's room that it's like has a huge like walk-in closet. There's a terrace. You can see an ensuite bathroom in this little kid's bedroom. I thought that was a very accurate detail. But yeah, Connor seems to have this like imaginary sort of Camelot notion of what the sort of nobility of his family or whatever, and which is, you know, we have not seen any evidence of that really. Yeah, I think him deciding to not go with Kendall is partly owed to that fantasy. But I would guess that also underneath that, you know, knowing he was sent on Operation Thumb Twiddle and all that, is that like, and his play is a fiasco and all that, like, I think he's just not ready to get out from under that wing. You know, if he steps out with Kendall, like, yes, he'll be given some, you know, when they're talking about the division of global control over this media empire that Kendall envisions, Kendall says to Connor, "And you'll get the rest," you know, whatever that is. And Connor looks sort of like, okay. I bet that there is some psychology in there where he's just like, I know deep down I can't actually handle real responsibility. I can't go out on my own. Like, I'm going to be with this guy till he dies, and then I'll inherit money and I'll probably just fade away, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah. He definitely started out like the least ambitious of the siblings. And I think even now, even though he has had these other irons in the fire, very bizarre irons in the fire, he doesn't really seem that driven to prove himself at Waystar Royco, at least. It's actually a little satisfying to compare to the sort of naked ambition that like you sometimes will see come from Roman, for example. There's something about Connor that feels like very confident, but not confident, that's not the right word, feel very comfortable, just kind of retreating. But you know, it, I'm actually very curious if that will shift, because the first two episodes, we've really hit this point a few times. Like, Connor's kind of useless. He's sort of off to the side. No one knows what to do with him. Operation Thumb Twiddle, whatever, whatever. And I wonder if, you know, kind of being either he might feel sort of frustrated by being labeled this way so much, or maybe other people around him might underestimate him. But I do think there's something a little dangerous about saying, oh, this guy, he's the oldest one. He's actually the one that's been in this environment the longest. Maybe he can't be written off so easily. Maybe he shouldn't be written off so easily.
Yeah. And there is something about, like, you know, he's clearly financially dependent on his father. He's reputationally dependent on his father and the family name. Yep. In terms of his other projects, his politics, his producing, whatever he's doing. But he is, in some senses, freer than the other three kids, because he doesn't have that, like, ambition to the particular throne, right?
Right.
And so he's kind of this volatile element who's like, obviously, his stake in it is the money, and some sense of loyalty. Yep. But beyond that, like, he's kind of a free agent. And so, you know, he obviously has shares, so it's worth, like, having him in your corner just for numbers. But there's something else there, too, that's interesting, which I think might be a good point to cut to your conversation with Alan Ruck, who plays Connor.
Yes, for sure.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Al and I was hoping to talk to you about episode 2.
Okay, let's see what I can recall.
I know, it's got to be a difficult position because you guys did this all so long ago and it all comes as a bulk, right, for you?
We did it in chunks. I mean, some of it we did, I think, in November of last year. And then I remember we did another piece of it at some later date. And we're like, what are we doing? Oh, right.
Was it harder? I mean, I imagine it's always hard when production's interrupted, but do you feel, it seems like you feel close to Connor. You don't seem to have you don't seem estranged from his feelings.
No, I mean, scarily, he might be written him close to who I am. They're just like, just make it be like Ruck.
He's well, in episode 2, the thing that I think one of the things I really liked about Connor in that episode is that you know, Kendall brings everyone to his apartment and wants to kind of I guess strategize, kind of wants everyone over on his side. And Connor, I think, is so unique with all the siblings. You know, he's older, he's kind of a little bit more detached from the sort of power dynamics that are at play. And he really doesn't need to be the CEO in order to, like, feel okay about himself. And that really is different from the other siblings. Do you think I'm right about that?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think he's got this grand plan, you know, for high political office, but I actually don't think he'd care to run Waystar Royco. I don't think he'd really be interested in doing that at all, you know.
He seems to be the most content at kind of being, like, a little bit removed from.
I do think it's starting to weigh on him that he has never had a job and he has no place to go and nobody needs him to show up to do anything. So I think that's starting to eat at him a little bit, you know, and so he's trying to, you know, pursue this political thing.
Yeah. I did think he had showed some interesting self-awareness out of the whole holding down the Balkans thing, which was such a obviously like made up task. And then, you know, you're on the phone with Brian Cox's character, Logan, and Connor's like, yeah, Operation Thumb Twiddle with my, and then the scheduled flight with the refrigerated cheeses. Connor was on a low point.
Yeah, poor Connor had to suffer through commercial first class. Yeah.
You know, it's a cross to bear for all of us.
Heart bleeds for him, I know.
So I think that the thing that I think the thing I wanted to really ask you about was just his relationships to the other siblings in this moment of profound change. Something that I often forget because Kendall so often ends up being like the most like forceful character is that Connor's actually the oldest and he's kind of been a Roy for the longest. He might have the most experience of all of them on how to deal with their dad.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're going to see some more of that as time goes on.
Yeah.
That sort of dynamic and, you know, making them aware that he does, in fact, have something to offer in terms of all that. he, you know, he is detached partially his own doing. I mean, the thing about Kendall at this point is that it becomes apparent pretty quickly that he slipped a cog. And he, coming from a guy who's delusional and has no plan. I mean, he has no plan. He just wants to be president. He has no idea how to do any of it.
Yeah.
But it's clear even to Connor that Kendall's just, you know, he's just taking pot shots at things. He doesn't know what he's doing. He's just flying by the seat of his pants and talking a big game.
Yeah, and he seems to be in such an different emotional register from Kendall in that whole scene. And then at the end, he says that he's not interested in joining Kendall because it's not right to kill your father, is what he says. I was curious about that line a little bit because no one's asking him to kill his father, but there's clearly some sort of like, I don't know, he kind of seems to have like a, Connor has this sense of like chivalry or something that he's calling to.
Well, I mean, I think when push comes to shove, he'll always come down on the side of the old man. I mean, even though Logan burned him at the end of season two and told him he was an embarrassment and so forth, I think there's something, it's like, I don't really want to take orders from my younger brother. However smart he might be, I just, you know, the ego, something gets involved and it's just like, I don't want to do that.
They all have so much pride and it really does prevent all of the siblings from working together a little bit more closely. Something also really funny is that the donuts thing happens in this episode where Logan sends the donuts. And I really felt as if maybe Logan sending the donuts did kind of influence everyone a little bit, like did kind of spook everyone.
Oh yeah. He knew exactly where we were. He knew exactly what we were doing and he knew how to get under everybody's skin, you know, and
they're probably safe to eat, but no one's sure.
No. And, you know, it's just like our father has eyes and ears everywhere and, you know, and you just figure that he's always going to be a couple of steps ahead of Kendall.
Yeah. Have you guys established exactly what the age difference is between Connor and Kendall?
Well, let's say, I mean, I'm playing younger than I actually am. Let's say I'm playing about 10 years younger than I am. Right.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. Say I'm about 55.
Uh-huh.
So my dad divorced my mother when I was, say, eight, somewhere in there, eight or nine. So at least 45 years ago. Mm-hmm. And Kendall's just now celebrating his 40th birthday. So I think I'm 15 years older than him.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, so maybe 17 or 18 years older than Roman, and then about 20 years older than Shiv.
That's such a, like, it's genuinely a generational difference. Like, you have such a different perspective on the family that they do. It's funny, because on the opening credits, they kind of make you guys look the same age, but clearly there's a difference, a big shift there. And another moment that I think really speaks to that that difference in this episode is when Shiv makes fun of Roman so much that he has to leave the room. And then Connor, and I hadn't seen Connor do something like this before, is like, I'm gonna go get him, I'm gonna like calm him down and like bring him back into the fold, which is such an older brother thing to do, and is also like a dynamic that's so necessary in this family, because you can't just alienate everyone constantly, someone has to be bringing people together. I thought that was like a really sweet thing that he did, and Connor doesn't have any particular reason to be nice to Roman, so I thought that was, it showed some unexpected character.
Yeah, I think he actually hopes and dreams that his step siblings will love and value him at some point, which they don't, you know. But he's holding out. He's dreaming, you know, that one day they're going to come to him and say, "Connor, I have something I need to talk to you about," you know, and be a confidant. And
yeah, I genuinely felt more sad for him than I had previously. You know, I think once Connor started his political ambitions, I got like more frustrated, you know, with the character. I was like, please stop. But in this moment, I began to see more of just the weird position he is in this family, and how that keeps getting weirder as everything goes on.
Yeah, just peeling back the layers of that onion. And
my last question is just some curiosity about how Connor's going to handle this Broadway flop, and if we can expect a little bit more Broadway plotting as we move forward this season.
How much have you seen?
I've seen the first few episodes, but this podcast is for episode two only. So, yeah, we'll be seeing more.
Yeah, I can't remember where I At a certain point, I decide that Willa is more important than money.
Oh, that's really beautiful. I was a little worried about those two.
Yeah, but it was hard for him. You know, he struggled with it a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm proud of him. Well, this is great. Thank you so much for giving us a few words on the podcast. We're all such big fans of the show.
I'm glad. Thank you. Right.
Thank you so much, Alan.
I'm Claire Fallon.
And I'm Emma Gray. We're culture writers, podcasters, and hosts of the show Love to See It.
Every week, we give an unapologetically feminist dissection of reality dating shows, rom-coms, and other romance narratives. We unpack all the weird messages they send us about love, sex, and dating.
And we dive into all the details with special guests like actors, authors, and cultural critics.
You can find Love to See It wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop every Tuesday.
So let's move on to the season three's most psychosexual pairing, Roman and Jerry. Where did we find them this week, Sonia?
So I was really into Roman's narrative this week because I feel like I was surprised to see him show up at Kendall's, and he comes straight from a little powwow with Jerry, settling into her new digs at Waystar Royco. She's taking a picture of her name on the screen, which is so cute, and then she is sending it to her daughters, because it turns out she has daughters. Roman's like, "Oh, like your daughters," and Jerry's like, "Don't talk to me about my daughters," which is like another, I mean, speaking of psychosexual, another fascinating little moment between these two people. But then once Roman sort of enters Kendall's orbit, I think what I found really engaging about the way Kieran Culkin plays this character too is he's so cynical and almost like it's like pessimistic about beating Logan or superseding Logan, and I think underneath that is this like actual sadness or anger or something, because the way that Kendall's sort of trying to appeal to him and kind of like break him out of loyalty to Logan, none of it works. You know, Roman's really bought into whatever Logan's selling. And the episode begins with a little phone call between Logan and Roman where Logan tells Roman that he needs him, which is not something that Logan does very much. And what I think what he's specifically saying is you know, he wants Roman on his side, but I think he wants Roman to keep tabs on Jerry. And then now Roman's going over to Kendall. At the end of the episode, Roman, like, reports the whole conversation, or, like, many elements of the conversation with Kendall to Logan. So there's this really strong, like, loyalty connection there. But what Roman wants remains confusing and strange. I mean, he's happy that Jerry is in charge, I think. He seems happy to be able to influence Jerry sort of from the side. And then when he's back with Logan at the end, and once Shiv leaves Kendall, she comes back to Logan's fold too, he covers for Shiv, you know, makes this whole case that Shiv wasn't really interested in leaving Logan's side, but was actually trying to convince Kendall to, like, do all this stuff for the family. And I found myself wondering, like, what exactly Roman wants. Maybe Roman doesn't 100% know, but I think Kendall not being the favored son, and Connor having never really been the favored son, finally gives him a chance to, like, be the good son, and that seemed to be what was driving him.
Yeah, well, we've seen instances, you know, in this episode where we see Logan kind of be a little kinder, you know. Mm-hmm. Kind of, but while also manipulating his sons. And so, mm-hmm. like, Roman, for whatever reason, maybe because he's the baby, like, seems the most still kind of invested in that particular kind of attention from his father. But I think there's also the Jerry loyalty that, like, I know he's there to spy on her, but clearly there's something else happening there, too. But I did think that, like, there was a shift in their dynamic that we hadn't seen before. I mean, yes, we didn't know that Jerry had daughters before this, did we?
I don't think so.
I don't remember that detail. It was
out of nowhere to me. And yeah, it does really change, I think, like, it answered some questions for me about what her motivations are. You know, she has the family life she's trying to protect, but then it also, I think, raised interesting questions about what is this relationship she has with Roman? Is it the mommy, the maternal thing that they're both kind of into? Or what else is going on?
And then he's trying to, like, immediately step into this vizier role, or maybe not even vizier, maybe, like, well, now I'm the secret person pulling right. all the strings. You're just the figurehead. And she's like, no, your apprenticeship starts today. Like, okay, I'm going to take your suggestion about forming this committee into advisement. There are some good points there. But, you know, and I think Roman realizing that, like, he didn't really have her kind of in his corner in the same way he thought, or not wrapped around his finger, but, like, I think he saw someone malleable in Jerry. And then the minute she gets in that chair, she's like, no, no, no. I have worked for this independently without the last name to get here. I mean, probably through nefarious means, but, like, I think it's interesting to see Jerry assert. It's not dominance exactly, but a sense of, I actually wanted this. And yeah. I am a proud mom, and I'm taking a grainy, bad cell phone photo of a TV screen to show to my daughters because my name is in tiny script on some horrible news channel. Like, she does care about it, and I think that kind of earnest care seems a little alien to Roman, and maybe makes him more willing to, like, spy on her and be kind of colder toward her as we see later in the episode.
Right, of course. I mean, it's a family dynamic that's so different from the family dynamic that he grew up with, clearly. Right. And I think the way that adds some context to what sort of fuels his sort of attraction and sort of maybe more nefarious intentions with Jerry, I think that really that like put an interesting tone into it, you know, an interesting mood into the mix. And then the other note that was interesting is that during their little powwow at Kendall's apartment, Roman goes up to the roof and calls Jerry. And Jerry says that she thinks, and I wonder, you know, what her whole game in her head is, but she thinks that if they were to do Kendall's plan, that none of the siblings mm-hmm. would really end up being particularly powerful. And or at least they wouldn't be able to maintain a role at the company because they would be burned, essentially.
Zapped. That's the word they keep
zapped,
using.
Zapped. 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 Yeah, zapped. And so that I liked to, I think that was it goes back to this, the rivalry of between Roman and Kendall, and between Roman and Shiv too, I guess, but, you know, this need to be visible, to be seen, to be the person in the throne in some way, is ultimately, you know, it kind of feels like, it kind of feels like the paradox of working together, you know, like if everyone worked together, it would be a better organization. But because everyone wants their recognition, they're sort of forced into this much more contentious place. Yeah.
I think that Jerry introducing that concept of you guys could scramble over this and betray your father and work all the other shareholders and, you know, get the Hope Davis on board and whoever else, like, you know, and you probably still won't win, or you'll win, you'll beat your father, but you won't. None of you will take control.
Yeah,
and I honestly think those siblings have not considered that, and or maybe they have in a sort of dim sense, but like, you're telling me we do this coup de grace, we come together as four children, adult children, to do this thing and depose our father. You're telling us after all of that, we won't gain control. And Jerry, you know, Jerry sees this as an outsider. She knows what other people who are high up at Waystar Royco think about the family, what their aspirations to power are. And I mean, she doesn't say it outright, but I would imagine that like some of that thought in her head is like the board, shareholders, everyone is sick of this shit, this dynastic, you know, infighting, blah, blah, blah. The true way to forge ahead is not to have a new Roy person at the head of this company. It's to have a whole new management paradigm. And I think it's really telling that Jerry is the one to impart that idea to one of the kids.
Right. Sort someone who is like able to say like the family culture of this company is part of what is corroding it. What if we did it? What if we move this out of the personal space and into the professional space?
Right.
It is a company.
It's a little pathetic and embarrassing when put in that context. It's
right.
Like all you little brats squealing over this, you know, this toy that your dad has, like, but there are other adults in the room who like want the toy and also would be better handled, you know, would be better with the toy. And I think it reduces all of them to just like for a brief second, to the sort of nakedness of all the nepotism. It's like, none of this has been earned by any of you four kids. And, you know, we don't know much about Jerry's background. We don't know, you know, what sort of, you know, Chapin to Wharton pipeline she was in. But I don't know. I worry for Jerry because I think she's like one of the more human appealingly human characters on the show. And I think just a mention of like my daughters and the photo thing, like this world of the show is so oppressively, you know, and wonderfully acidic and nihilistic and cruel and backstabbing, that when you get a little glimpse of someone's kind of gentle humanity, it's like, oh, of course, right, the outside world, like being in a child's bedroom, you know, and she has all her little knickknacks and posters, and it's like, oh, right, like a small human lives here who, like, cares about the world. Like, I don't want too much of that sensitivity to seep into the show, but I think I like when a little little light comes in through the cracks.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's a good transition into talking about, you know, the other power couple that's having a phone conversation on the roof, Tom and Shiv, because, you know, Jerry has this outsider perspective. Tom is an outsider, but he doesn't really bring perspective. Like, he's very much like, how can I be as like deeply embedded into this mess as possible and sort of continue to like tweak the dynamics that are already at play. I think what I really loved / hated was how Tom and Shiv are so badly communicating with each other right now. Like that I love you exchange that they have is like painfully awkward stuff, but they really don't have anyone else. Like they really need each other right now. And I'm sort of enjoying how terrible their marriage is sort of feeling right now, because it's like, yeah, like this is the partnership you guys made. You decided, you know, that these family dynamics and the financial benefits of it were like more important than, your ability to like authentically communicate with each other or like state your needs or whatever it is. And so it just feels like, I don't know. I mean, I think Shiv was in an interesting place this whole episode, because Kendall sort of keeps trying to call her to action, you know, sort of says things like, can't human beings make a difference? Like, this is time to be someone. And Shiv is not interested in being someone in this episode.
No. And I love the exchange between Kendall and Shiv, where he's like, I'm you now, you know, or like, I'm what you're supposed to be or something. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes. And, yes.
Because he's like, I know you fancy yourself the sort of politically noble one, the you know, the sort of better thinker among us, the whatever. He's like, but that's me because I did this thing now, which, you know, we talked about this last week, like how like ultimately vain this whole and arrogant this whole like new Kendall thing is.
Yes.
But like, but he's kind of right, at least in how these two people perceive themselves.
Yes.
Like, Shiv is the one who has doubled down and gotten colder and more, you know, mercenary and just sort of like more calculating about this. And so has Kendall. I mean, he hasn't really changed, but he's at least putting out this forward facing thing of like, you know, I'm on the right side of history and we're going to change this company in the way that Shiv, you know, with all her working with Democrats and all that, used to be. And I think that's an interesting power flip that Kendall recognized, even if we're all just talking about surface identity stuff and not actual behavior.
Right. And all that Shiv can fall back on when she's talking to Kendall is essentially kind of nitpicky cynicism. Like, she, you know, he keeps trying to make the case that, like, you know, the company did a bad thing, like, we should do the right thing, or like, we don't want Dad to be in charge anymore because he is like a person that created this culture of entitled and possibly abusive white men, like, in charge of this company. And like, she has like agreed with those things in the past, but it's like there's this incredible obstruction of like ego in and I don't know, an unwillingness, I think, definitely a loyalty to her father, but there's so much blocking her, what we know to be like where her passion lies, or at least where her interests have been before the events of last season. And so it's like, it was very interesting watching her kind of just waffle. You know, this wasn't that much of an episode for Shiv. Like, she doesn't say things that are like particularly profound or assertive, almost because it's hard to like pin her on anything. She's kind of just squirming out of every niche that people are trying to find for her.
I mean, I was going to say, we saw this last week, where she, you know, she goes to see the lawyer, Lisa, right? And Lisa basically, without saying it, is like, you're not like this hero that you seem to kind of think you are. Like, Shiv kind of clinging to this old idea of herself, because that was, for a while at least in her adult life, like her identity within the family. She was the do-gooder, she was the forward thinker, whatever. And then, you know, but we saw her kind of sink back into the muck in last season and further in this season, or kind of questioning her place in the muck this season. And I think in that way, like, this is one of the more pertinent and darker portraits on the show. Like, you know, if we look outward into the real world at like, well, I'm a Democrat, and it's like, right, but you don't want to raise taxes on rich people or corporations, and you don't want to do XYZ, you want to protect oil companies, you know, like, yes, you can say you're something, but like, let's actually look at how you act and what choices you make. And I think Shiv is kind of emblematic of that realization that like, political position doesn't necessarily translate to any sort of morality. If you're not actually living the principles that you sort of claim to stand by, you know, does that make sense? I mean, am I overreaching there? I don't know.
No, I mean, I think what this all it makes me wonder who was Shiv when she was working for the candidate played by Eric Bogosian, right, and stuff. Like, was she making decisions that were closer in line with what she said her moral views were? Because now the whatever principles those were do not seem to apply to her anymore, and it does make her feel very there's something very suspicious and sort of shifty about how fast that happened. I want to talk about the conversation that Logan and Shiv have, but let's talk about Greg for a second, and then we'll talk about Logan and we'll end with that moment. Because Greg starts out with Kendall at the beginning and then spends the episode kind of on his personal walkabout of trying to find an attorney.
It's his little green knight journey.
he really does have he has challenges. He meets strange figures and has to figure out how to deal
Greg's
with them.
Tale is part of Canterbury Tales, right?
Yeah, it's like one of those quests. Absolutely. I loved everything that happened with him, which is essentially that he meets a friend who is a law student, tries to have a conversation with a Waystar Royko lawyer, and then ultimately sends that lawyer away.
Which is
and
a really then, sinister kind of Michael Clayton-esque scene with this guy. He's like, how did you get into the building? But you forget that he doesn't own that apartment, you know?
Yeah, of
and
course.
So this sinister guy just showing up and being like, I'm your lawyer now. It's tell me what you know. Spooky.
Right, and even says, when the FBI comes looking for you, or wants to talk to you, we'll just tell them to talk to me. And Greg's I don't know if I want that. Could I? And so what I loved about, in addition to just Nicholas Braun hedging his way through every conversation, I almost felt so proud of him, because I was like, this is actually, it's very frustrating behavior, but it's actually perfect. Don't commit anything to anyone. Don't say anything to anyone. You're like, he even to Tom on the phone, he's like, I might maybe didn't have anything to do with this.
He's I'm not with them necessarily, it's right. Just really, yeah.
It's kind of spectacular, because I think it is so frustrating, but he is doing almost exactly what he needs to sort of evade being pinned down further. But then what ends up becoming kind of an unexpected development is that he finds his grandfather and ends up using the lawyer that his grandfather sets up for him, who appears to be just a rank anti-capitalist who wants to use Greg's case not just to protect Greg. He did say he wants to protect Greg, but he also wants to
dismantle capitalism.
Right. Make a case that Waystar Royko is bad for the world. Right. So really unexpected zag over to that direction. Greg didn't seem super fazed by it. He sort of seemed to think that was okay. But yeah, I was curious what you thought about that.
I mean, I think the grandfather character played by James Cromwell, Logan Roy's brother, has always been such a funny character, because he says things throughout this show where you're like, yeah, finally someone said it. But he's also at some point been somewhat complicit in all this. He's sort of still awash in family money and whatnot. I don't know actually how much he does want to protect Greg. I think he's, sort of using him as a pawn, he's like, you're a wedge, right? Mm-hmm. I think that he doesn't have too much of Greg's well-being in mind there. But I'm curious to see where this sort of destroy from within plotline goes, if it goes anywhere, because Greg is clearly beholden to his grandfather to some extent, and so will do his bidding to some extent, only so far, but we've also seen, like you said in this episode, how much he kind of equivocates and is like, well, maybe not. It was funny watching the grandfather come hobbling out of the Cooper Union building. I was like, are you going to design school? What's in that building?
Yeah, that was an unexpected thing. I also really loved that he called Kendall a self-regarding popinjay. Fantastic words. I have a feeling Greg doesn't even understand any of them. I mean, I think if we had the D&D alignment chart of Succession, I think Greg might be true neutral, because in a way he's sort of willing to make peace with anyone who's going to take care of him, I think. I think, what happened with with Logan was this $5 million deal wasn't enough at the end of last season. Like he comes to realize that. And so he throws in his lot with Kendall, but then he's like walking out of Kendall's building and he's on the phone with Tom. And Tom's like, oh, like, what are you up to? Like, blah, blah, blah. And Greg tells Tom that Shiv is there, you know, kind of as quickly as possible, sort of tries to ingratiate himself or let Tom know that he's willing to tell him secrets of some kind. So he's like allied with Tom. He's allied with Kendall. He's allied with his grandfather. He's got tentacles.
It makes me think of I was, you know, in my worst days in high school where I would, you know, you tell someone a secret so you can ingratiate yourself to them about someone else, you know? And so you're like, now I have all these allegiances, like these kind of secret pacts and all that. And it like, it ends up usually blowing up in your face. So
yeah.
I'll be curious. And I thought there was a funny thing in the scene with the lawyer. I believe that was Peter Reichert playing him. Where Greg is like kind of realizing like, oh, they have a much bigger mission in mind. And he just has to like clarify. He's like, I just am thinking about myself and I don't want to go to jail or get fired. And in that brief moment, you're like, why would you want this job? You should get fired. Get like, you know, like go be free, go enjoy your night. I mean, I guess he still wouldn't still have the apartment, but like, I love when he's with that friend who's a law school student. Mm-hmm. And she's like, you know, marveling at how nice the apartment is. And again, with like Jerry taking the photo, it's like, right, there are human beings who are like, oh, wow, this is a nice place. You know, like a little bit of like perspective is nice. But Greg just cannot see it. All this scramble, he's being used by all sides. And he still doesn't want to. He still wants to stay at the company, which I think is sort of tragic.
It is tragic. Yes, it is Peter Reichert looking very cool and sort of you know, lefty lawyer, very disorganized. So really fun to have James Cromwell back, and then also to introduce Peter Reichert into Greg's life. Creates like very interesting stoic figures for him to be a complete, you know, completely degenerate jerk in near. Okay.
And Peter Reichert's one of those actors where it's like, how has he not been on the show yet? like it's a natural fit. Like
I think it's going to be exciting. Yeah. Okay. And then, so then that brings us to Sarajevo. What's happening in Sarajevo? Which is Logan, Hugo, Tom, who's still out there and mostly just answering phone calls from Shiv, and Marsha, Hiyama's Marsha, who has been sort of summoned, and I guess she's been summoned to reconcile. Logan reconciles with her in the lobby of the hotel, and then Marsha and her like person, her assistant Celeste, sit down with Hugo and start to hammer out a substantial financial package that comes with Marsha being back on board. Yeah.
The numbers I'm going to say might sound very large, but when you consider, I just love the way she frames it. I also, like, in a dark way, love when they're in the lobby and she's like, you know, talking about the Holly Hunter situation from last season and how embarrassed she was, and you know, and Logan just kind of is like, frowns. He's like, I can't eat shit. I just can't. Like Ahmed, that's his apology. Is, ugh, you know, I can't actually apologize. That's just not in my nature. And she's like, okay.
No, it was sort of maddening that it worked. Like that somehow his complete inability to actually apologize or be humble in any way. And she goes for it, I think probably because she knows that Celeste and Hugo are going to make it very lucrative for her to do so. But it's so, I think it's one of these moments Succession does really well, where you see the interpersonal relationship and then you see the financial underpinnings of their relationship in a very like physical way. You know, Hugo and Celeste are in the foreground, and Marsha gets up from that table and walks back to where Logan is. And of course, Logan's not at the table because he can't be bothered with figuring out the particulars of why the people he loves, or quotes, I don't know, purports to love, I don't even know if it's love, are in his life. Like, he can't be bothered with the details, but of course,
but he's within earshot. Like, this is just a part of their you know, I was thinking watching The Last Duel, the movie that's out this week or out last week, where there's just a very calm conversation about like dowry, you know, and it's like that, like for certain, you know, of old, but also of now, like there, that money aspect is a part and parcel with like supposed romantic coupling, you know, or whatever else, like that's just how it works. And I guess what I'm curious about with Marcia, because I've always liked her character as this kind of watchful person on the outside who's probably a lot more involved than we know and sort of, you know, pulling strings here and there, is she's already a stakeholder to some extent, right? But like, it sounded to me like this negotiation was basically kind of giving her more ownership, right? To some extent, like not like a majority share or anything like that, but like more investment in the company itself. Or did I misread that?
No, I didn't sound like she was getting like a board seat or more of that, because she already has a seat, I think, right? But it sounded like she was going to get something set up for someone else in her family, and that there was like her daughter, and then there was also going to be like a the trust. She was going to be like put more in charge of a trust. But like, it's a really good question. Like, can she expand her footprint on in that company? And then how does that affect, you know, what happens from here on out?
It makes her a player on the board more than she already is, you know? And as Kendall is trying to amass, you know, to get, you know, majority vote or whatever, it's potential that she could become part of that strategy. I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and that is something that we didn't talk on, but very briefly to touch on it, Kendall says he's going to go talk to his daughter and leaves all the siblings to go have a conversation with Stewie and Sandy in a car. And it kind of feels like we're back on familiar territory, because he's back to trying to wrangle these votes to get
Stewie,
the
one who keeps getting away, his great lost love that he just...
Yeah. Yeah, with a really inexplicably awful name, I think. But, you know, that's that. So that's this episode, I think. I mean, and overall, I would say I really enjoyed kind of the machinations of it and made me excited to see what comes next.
Well, I think, you know, we should close on this car, this conversation in the car, right? With Logan and Shiv, where basically Logan basically says to her that, like, you're going to wear a hazmat suit by the name of Jerry or whatever her last name. Like he's basically saying, like, I put her out to like fuck her. Like she's going to be.
Yeah.
She's going to be cover for all of us, which is like, wow, I thought Jerry was actually one of the ones he liked, you know?
Yeah. There's something, it doesn't bode well for Jerry. It doesn't seem to bode well, but I wonder, I mean, I also think this is part of the 3D chess. Logan, earlier in the episode, it had been pointed out that Shiv doesn't really have a role at the company. So how could she? Never has. So how could she become the CEO if she's never had a role at this company? So Logan's bringing her into the company, which I think is something she wants, and kind of puts her on the path towards CEO. But then, yeah, very explicitly is sort of like, you are going to be, you know, my eyes and ears. You're going to be making sure that you are like fixated on Jerry, because like now Jerry is in charge. And then the whole way that Logan also advances this to Shiv is like, he goes up to the car where Tom has gone in to sit down next to his wife, makes Tom get out and move to the front seat so that Logan can sit down next to her. And very, as he's walking out of the plane, you know, very ostentatiously kind of ignores Jerry, who then gets into the car with Roman. So again, why does Logan have to play this game where he just instated Jerry? Why can't he even pretend to be nice to her? That I'm not so sure about, but he's mad. He's mad. He's no longer in charge. And so he's just going to make everyone else feel miserable too.
Right. Yeah. Such is his nature and such his children's nature. And yeah. but no, I think it's setting up exciting things. You know, I'll be curious to see if we jump in time. But in the meanwhile, Please do email us your questions, your theories, all that at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. And Sonia, until we meet with the Roys again next week, where can people find you?
I will be a self-regarding Poppin' Jay who washes dirty laundry in public, just like Kendall Roy, but I will be on VF.com and intermittently on social media as well.
Well, I will be remodeling my bedroom to have a balcony and a walk-in closet and an ensuite bathroom, just like any 10-year-old in Manhattan should have. And I'll be tweeting at Rylaws and writing also at VF.com. Once again, this episode was edited and produced by Dave Gonzalez. And we'll talk to you next week.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.